Early Jewish believers in Yeshua created a catechism for new disciples from among the nations. Lost for hundreds of years, this document, called the Didache, reveals the expectations and standards the early Yeshua-believing community put in place for Gentile disciples of Yeshua. Our guest today, Dr. Daniel Nassim, has spent his academic career demonstrating that the first disciples of Yeshua considered the Torah to be the moral compass of all those who joined the community of disciples, whether Jewish or Gentile.
Put your hand in mine together. We will walk in harmony. Let me introduce you to my teacher, the rabbi from the Galilee.
You're listening to Messiah Podcast, where Jesus is Jewish and that changes everything. Messiah Podcast is a production of First Fruits of Zion. All right, welcome to Messiah Podcast, Dr. Daniel Nassim. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We always jump at the chance to get a Messianic Jewish PhD. There are more than I thought there would be, and it's heartening to know because... any movement that finds itself trying to aspire to a certain definition, it's always better to have people who know what they're talking about and can parse the ancient texts and know the secondary literature and can say, look, this is legit. You know what I mean? This is the real thing is happening here. And, we have a deepening bench, and I'm glad to see that.
Yeah.
Your PhD is from the University of Exeter, which is just as prestigious as it sounds. And you did your doctoral work on a specific document, a treasure of the early church lost for hundreds of years, rediscovered in Constantinople in 1873 by a Greek Orthodox metropolitan named Philotheos Vrienios. I think I'm getting that right.
Yeah.
As part of a codex that came to be called Hierosolymitanus. Amazing story. This guy never got as famous as Tischendorf or anything like that, but I think it's just fascinating that this even happened. Now, I haven't said the name of this document yet because I don't know how to pronounce Greek words and I'm afraid I'm going to look like a fool. So my first question is, what is the title? Can you please pronounce the title of the work on which you've spent so much time and have become a world-renowned expert?
Well, most people just call it the Didache. I suppose you could be really pedantic and call it the Didache, but Didache is the most common pronunciation, and it's the teaching of the Lord through the 12 apostles for the Gentiles. That's the full title.
Even the title is really provocative, because that's what I always wanted. I wanted to know what the master had to say to Gentiles, because as a keen reader of the Gospels will note, mostly he's talking to other Jewish people. And sort of at the end, we get this great commission, now go to the nations and tell them everything I commanded you. I would say this document fills an important niche. Can you elaborate a little bit for maybe some of our listeners have never heard of this thing? I certainly hadn't until probably I was in seminary. What is the Didache?
The Didache is really, in many ways, a discipleship and a congregation manual. The first half of it is basically to do with issues as to how a believer should live. And the second part is to do basically with issues how the community should conduct itself. And then in the middle, between those two, there are a few items such as the Lord's Prayer and information on immersions that are both communal and individual. So it clearly has a trajectory through it. It was written in the first century, I would say around the year 80 at the latest, but it's a composite of a number of documents, some of which go right back and can be seen reflected in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So some of those actually predate the Messianic movement and even Yeshua himself. So it's a very valuable book. It seems to have been written by Jewish believers. It really would be hard to argue anything else effectively. We don't know for certain where it was written. Most people would say Antioch, which is, you know, a couple hundred miles north of Jerusalem, within reach, but not close. And yet that would be a good possible location for at least the target audience, because Antioch was very much a community of both Jews and Gentiles, and had been actually such a community since Alexander the Great, since 300 BCE. It had been the city where Jews and Gentiles lived together in pretty good harmony, apart from a few events that occurred later in the first century. And it really reflects both the inherent presuppositions of the early Jewish believers, their beliefs that remained unshaken in the permanence and value of Torah, but at the same time reflects that same passion that's reflected throughout the Gospels, which is the Gospel has come to the Jews, but ultimately God's plan is for all the nations. And so the writers of this really had a heart for these grassroots congregations that were springing up throughout what was called Syria at the time, which includes what we call Lebanon and Syria today. These congregations are springing up. A lot of them need direction. And we've seen the same thing happen in the Messianic movement and the Hebrew Roots movement, groups springing up and looking for information. And they didn't have the internet with all of its problems back then, but they didn't have much at all.
Yeah.
So a letter like this was tremendously valuable because it kind of gave them instruction. What do you do when, you know, some weirdo turns up at your door and says he's a prophet? You know, is he real? Should you listen to him? Should you feed him for 6 months or kick him out? You know, it deals with real practical issues that people were dealing with back then.
That's fascinating. And I remember before hearing about the Didache, I remember being in seminary I got a bachelor's degree in religion from Liberty University, and I went to high school through some Christian curriculum. So I'd read, for purposes of getting a grade, I'd read the Bible like three times. And in seminary, I just remember thinking, like, it seems like, you know, every document in the New Testament was written for an occasion and purpose. And, you know, Paul writing to a church is going to tell them what he thinks they need in that situation. But wouldn't it, why don't we have a catechism or something like that? How come the apostles didn't leave something for everyone, something that's just generally applicable? And then I saw that the Didache existed and I thought, this is what I've been looking for.
Yeah. It really gives you, as many people say, a window into their world back then. It's not Bible, but actually it was considered as a candidate for the New Testament in the early days. It almost made its way in, but it clearly is not scripture. It's not at the same level of profundity and, you know, of importance maybe, but at the same time, it tells you exactly what they thought. And the beauty of the Didache is, unlike, say, the Gospel of Thomas or other writings that we found from the first century and on papyri and later, this one is one of those that is completely orthodox in every respect. It does a beautiful job of kind of threading the fine line in between maybe what scholars used to call the Pauline faction and the Petrine or James faction of the early believers. It doesn't tread on the toes of either, but comes to a really, really good practical analysis and description of how believers should live and what our responsibilities are. Whether really it's written to Gentiles, but I think implicitly it has relevance to Jews as well. You can see where the authors are coming from.
So you mentioned that the Didache is very early, maybe 80, around the year 80. It's the sort of a document that I wish that I could have had early on in my discipleship. But I'm thinking about the community at that time, right? At some point, because in your book, you talk about how a lot of this stuff would have been transmitted orally. You mentioned that literacy wasn't necessarily so high in that period of time. Maybe not as low as some people think, but not as high as 100%, you know, maybe 15%, 20%. So at some point, this body of tradition that we call the Didache went from being just something that people told each other and something that people had memorized and were telling to new converts. Someone decided that this had to be written down and it had to be concretized. And I sort of wonder, what was happening at the time that someone was like, oh, this isn't going to work anymore. We need to make this, we need to carve this in stone, or as the case may be, papyrus. With every ancient document, you have an occasion, an author, and an audience, right? Important context. What was the occasion for the writing down of the Didache?
Yeah, that's such a great question, because it really ties into Jewish history as well. Because when Jerusalem is destroyed, remember, Yavne is established and the rabbinic establishment is moved there. And we begin the process of the writing down of the Mishnah, because times are really tumultuous. And the Jewish community knows that the knowledge of the Zugot, the early rabbis, and those following them too, must not be forgotten. So they begin a process of systematizing and organizing what they know, and we have the Mishnah. And you can see that a similar response is happening in the Didache. In the midst of a very tumultuous time, Jerusalem being destroyed, the Jewish people, far from being humbled, they're not really humbled by that, because we have another war later called the Kitos Rebellion, and then you have the destruction of the entire city in 135. So there's mm-hmm. still, an edge. In the midst of that very difficult political environment and social environment, the Didache is trying to help congregations know how they ought to deal both with their personal lives and with the many people who are dislocated, the many displaced persons who are wandering around, going from city to city, doing odd jobs, maybe posing as prophets in order to get free food. How do you deal with this, and how do you maintain your balance in the middle of a crazy world? And I think that's really the background to the Didache here.
Maybe for those who don't have the tools that you have, as someone just sits down to read this thing, maybe they're reading a translation that they Googled on the internet, which is fine. Go ahead and do that. Go ahead and just go read the Didache. It's not that long. You can read it in one sitting. It's fascinating. But what might people be looking for as far as initial clues that this document is of, some might say, Christian Jewish or Jewish Christian or Messianic Jewish provenance?
I think part of the answer to that is the fact that it was so well received. We have fragments of this that have been found in various languages, including Ge'ez from Ethiopia.
Wow.
It had a wide reception, as they call it. It got around. And then we find other documents after it, say the, not the Gospel of Barnabas, but there's a book just called Barnabas. And it includes a good chunk of the Didache in it. It's kind of all twisted and mixed up, but nevertheless, it's there. And you can see it drew on the previous document. And then even centuries later, you have the Apostolic Canons, which include a number. It's a book that includes a number of different church orders or church manuals. And again, it includes, the majority of the Didache in it. And actually, the canons do a pretty good job of copying it in. But really, it was lost from, basically lost from the early church right on until the year 1072, when a scribe called Leon the Sinner, that's how he describes himself, transcribed it into a book, and it was left in the library in Constantinople, which is Istanbul today. And then again, it was just kind of forgotten until it was discovered by Philotheos Briennios in, I think it was 1873, and then it was published, a decade later.
Yeah.
So it really was kind of a forgotten book, and yet the church fathers refer to it, but you don't You don't see that much about it until it explodes on the scene, you know, in the late 1800s.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of people started talking about it right away. And we'll get into some of that in a second. So you mentioned the age of this, at least the earliest stratum of the Didache seems to maybe even just predate the Yeshua movement altogether. Like maybe this section, the first six chapters or so, a lot of it may have just been, here's what Judaism is to a person who might not have had any idea. In what context would a document like that have been useful? And do we have any other examples of that sort of thing that have survived?
You know, we have examples of even some of Yeshua's sayings are actually sayings that were also said by the Jewish people of his day. Mm. You know, even the Golden Rule, maybe in slightly different wording, but it's basically the same, do unto others as you would have them do to you. We see that in Hillel, who was a contemporary of Yeshua, at least in Yeshua's very early youth. And so you see that even in the New Testament, but such a big chunk like this, even the general format of the whole book, the general arc that it takes from the individual to the communal is very reflective of a scroll called the Manual of Discipline, or the Serek HaYachad, as we call it in Hebrew. And the Serek is a book that was designed to induct people into the Essene community. We presume it was the Essenes. And it had all the principles and rules by which you needed to live if you were to be part of that community. And the Didache is far from being a transcription of it. It's not just a copy, but nevertheless, there are so many similarities and verbal connections that you can see that the writers of the Didache were really familiar with that. And I don't think it's because they went out and studied it particularly, like, oh, let's find some old writings of our Jewish people and use those. But I think it was because it was their world. Yeshua and the Shlichim, or his Talmudim, the disciples, they were first century Jews, Second Temple Jews, mm-hmm. who lived in the absolute heyday of the Second Temple before its destruction, when it was at its peak. And the greatest scholars of Judaism were alive in their day. And so this was what people knew. This wasn't just them. And so when the apostles taught among the early believers in Jerusalem, remember Acts 2:42, they went from house to house, you know, hearing the teaching of the apostles. When they taught out of their framework, and there was no hint that there should be any contradiction between the Judaism that they knew, which people didn't even really call Judaism per se, but nevertheless, the faith of their people that they knew, and Yeshua, they were one and the same. And so they saw no problem with drawing on what was good out of their own milieu, their own culture, their own people.
That's fascinating. Now, that Manual of Discipline was one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, it was one of the first ones discovered in the first cave.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we had the Didache starting in 1873, and then in the 1940s, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls. Did that just blow everybody's mind? Was that like a revolution in Didache research when we found the Serac?
Yeah, that was a total revolution, because when it was first published by Bryennios in Greek, because he is a Greek person, so he published his whole commentary, or his whole, what they call princeps, his first initial publication of the document. When he published it, he and Adolf Harnack, who was the preeminent scholar of the Second Temple Judaism, early Christianity in those days, they were convinced this was a very early Christian Jewish or Jewish Christian document. And yet within a couple decades, you started having British scholars like this guy Robinson in England, from Aberdeen, who contended that the Didache was actually a really bad copy and a fraud of the book of Barnabas that had been written actually in 135.
Wow.
So he not only gave it a later date, but he said it was a fraud.
Mm.
Now, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered and the Sarek HaYachad, the Manual of Discipline, was published or first became available to scholars, Jean-Paul Audet, a French-Canadian Catholic scholar, started studying it, and he published an article. And this is really illustrative of how sometimes it doesn't take a book. Sometimes one article in a journal can change everything.
Yeah.
He published an article talking about the textual affinities between the Manual of Discipline and the Didache. And all of a sudden, that just blew everything out of the water again, because now everyone knew for sure this Didache was not dependent on Barnabas, but was dependent and related to the teaching of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Sarek in particular.
Wow.
So really, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls are revolutionary for that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we wouldn't have a new perspective on Paul probably without the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's a whole lot. They did change everything.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I mean, it sounds like the Didache is not just a window into early Jewish Christianity, but it tells us something about Judaism. I mean, as an example of like a Jewish catechism for newbies, just in a really specific context of, well, the newbies this time are Gentiles who are not converting. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
So you have published this book, Torah for Gentiles? This is the
right.
This is part of the fruit of your intense labor into study of the Didache, and like most academic monographs, and this is an academic monograph. It's for those of you. I mean, I would encourage go ahead, everybody, go buy this and read it. If you don't have a passing knowledge of French, German, and Koine Greek, you might have to pull up Google Translate once in a while, but don't let that stop you. Don't let that be a barrier for you getting this information. But like most academic monographs, you carefully define the scope of what you're trying to demonstrate, which I really appreciate. And it's one of the reasons I prefer these kinds of sources. What is this book about? What's your thesis for the book Torah for Gentiles?
I think that's a good question, because When you're doing a study like this, you're just looking at the piece of data, you know, your own topic, and you have to be really careful about where you take it from there. This is about the Didache. This is not necessarily the teaching of the New Testament. Now, I believe it is completely congruent with the teaching of the New Testament. But nevertheless, one needs to be clear. This is what the writers of the Didache wrote. We don't even know who they are, except they must have been Jews and they were writing with Gentiles in mind. We know that it was what they wrote, and it was a discipleship manual telling the Gentiles how they ought to live. And it includes all kinds of maybe stereotypical, even biased, the same kind of bias you see sometimes in Paul's writings when he talks about the sinners of the Gentiles. There's maybe almost bigotry, we'd say, in the 21st century now. But
sure.
But it includes issues that, from the standpoint of the Jewish writers, were typically Gentile problems. And some of them were. So, for example, you shall not kill a baby in its infancy. That was related to the practice of exposing among Greeks and Romans. If you didn't want a child, you just left them on the dump in the outside in the open. And if someone picked up that child, fine, but you know, you left it there to die.
Mm.
And the Didache says, no, you know, that's not something you do if you are on the way to life.
Yeah.
It uses a paradigm from the Hebrew Bible that we see especially in Deuteronomy 29, 30, 31, with Moses saying, I set before you the way of life and the way of death, the way of blessing, the way of curses. And the Didache uses that, and it uses the Mosaic, you know, Hebrew terminology, way of life and death, which links it particularly to the Torah and tells you that these are people who have the Torah in mind. And then as it teaches it, it is clearly not trying to say that the Torah is in every respect specifically applicable to its audience, the Gentile audience. So there are many things it doesn't discuss, but it addresses primarily the issues that they were facing in their life. So when the book is written, it is written specifically to see the connection in the minds of the authors between discipleship and the way a person should live if they are on the way of life, and on their beliefs about the Torah. And clearly they believe the Torah is still relevant, and still relevant to everybody on earth, including their Gentile audience, because they use Torah, they use the language of Torah in explaining how everyone should live.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's one thing to say, as, you know, various scholars have realized back into the 1700s, that there were Jewish Christians or Christian Jews or Messianic Jews who continued to live according to their ancient traditions. It's another a step, and I think a good step, to realize that, well, okay, the Gentiles were coming in. They were coming out of a situation where they had no idea what was going on. I mean, without hope, without God in the world, Paul's pretty clear. These people knew nothing. Starting from scratch. You know, they didn't go to Sunday school. They weren't like a lot of Christians today. They were coming out of a culture that just had no idea. They needed moral teaching, ethical teaching, clarity as to what was good and bad, good and evil, vice and virtue. And to be able to say, look, the people who knew what they were talking about, what they were drawing from, and I would include Paul in this too, what they were drawing from as they gave these lists of don't do this and do this, it was all the Torah. I mean, that was,
yeah.
Where else are you going to get this stuff from? I mean,
well, you know, to be honest, the Stoics actually had lists a bit like that as well. And I think this an area. Yeah. I mean, it's been studied, but I don't think it's been studied enough. The connection between the lists in the Bible, the virtue and vice lists, as we call them, and the virtue and vice lists of people like the Stoics. But nevertheless, the ones in the New Testament are biblically based.
Yeah.
And so basically, you know, what it is it's a good example of when you're speaking to people, you speak in the language they knew. Yeshua spoke to the Israelites, to the people of Israel in terms that were relevant to them. And Paul speaks in terms that are relevant to his largely Greek and Roman audience. And so they're just using the format of the day. Hmm. And these lists are tremendously powerful because they show that even in the first century, in pagan culture, people had the same paradigm in their mind. Moses says the way of life, the way of death. And they had stories like the story of Heracles at the Y. You know, this young man, he's at the crossroads. You know, there's a Y in front of him. Which way am I going to go? The way of pleasure that's going to lead to destruction, or the way, you know, maybe self-denial to some degree, the narrow way, as Yeshua put it, that leads to life. And that's a paradigm in their thinking too. So you have these lists that were part of moral instruction in Greek society too. But they didn't include things like you shall not commit idolatry. They didn't have things like you shall not murder a child in the womb. And so they didn't address issues that they didn't think were issues, but Jews knew where.
Yeah, that's, I mean, how, you know, it seems very effective to take the content of the Torah and package it in something that was recognizable to the audience. I mean, just that by itself is an incredible, I won't say attempt, because I think it was successful. Was it a Herculean feat? I don't know if it was that difficult, but it was innovative and effective. I'm assuming it was effective. It worked on me.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that this is replicated in later Christian documents, that they take and adapt the Didache's teaching like this, tells you that it was well received and they understood what was behind it. And even though the early church rapidly became anti-Torah, which I think is from a misunderstanding of Rav Shaul's teachings, which that's some a place that this Didache study doesn't go. But even though the church was anti-Torah, nevertheless, they replicated this discussion and this teaching, which really is Torah-based. And, you know, it replicates particularly the second table of the commandments. You know, the first table of the commandments, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. All seems to be in some ways universal teaching, but specifically adapted for the children of Israel, including, you know, you shall keep these commands so you will live long in the land and so forth. You know, that's stuff that is specifically related to Israel. But the second table of the commandments, the second five, do not commit murder, do not commit adultery, do not steal. That is word for word in the Didache's teaching of the two ways, three times in a row, twice in a description of the way of life, and then the third time, the same five commands are there in terms of the teaching of the way of death. Do not do these things.
What did people think about that in the 1800s? They must have seen the Decalogue right there in the Didache. How come Harnack didn't say this is Torah for Gentiles? I mean, was it just he didn't quite have the worldview to be able to make that leap? Or, you know, how come it took until 2021 for someone to say, this is the Torah and it's for Gentiles? It's right there in the text.
Well, I think some people have been saying it. And actually, Tony Janicki wrote a great book by First Fruits of Zion.
Oh, Toby.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have that right here.
The Way of Life. It's fantastic. It's written with a pastoral heart. It's not particularly written for scholars, but on the other hand, he drew on all the scholarship that was available. He did an excellent job.
Yeah. Didn't you help him out a little bit with that?
I think he had me look at the manuscript or something like that at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. And give some feedback. But I'm really, really pleased.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is, you know, Torah for Gentiles is amazing. You know, I think anyone should be able to read it. But if you can't read it, if you can't dive into the academic side and you don't know any French, German, or Koine Greek, you can always get The Way of Life by Toby Janicki. I think you guys came to like similar conclusions. I think you guys have a really similar worldview.
Yeah.
One thing that I think you guys both concluded was something that it still blows my mind.
Yeah.
Which is what to take away from the fact that you have sayings of Yeshua in the Didache that are similar, but not identical to sayings of Yeshua in the Gospels. there's a remarkable conclusion that you guys come to from that information. It may not be intuitive to our listeners. Can you explain what does it mean that we have very similar, but not copied, not identical language of these sayings of Yeshua in the Didache and in the Gospels?
Yeah, it is fascinating. And actually, in some respects, in some quotations, it is actually identical. And I think that points to the very early date of this. This is even before some of the Gospels were written. This is when the sayings of Jesus, Yeshua, are still being passed around verbally or maybe in smaller documents among the early believers. You know, we obviously have a record of possibly an ancient copy of Matthew in Hebrew, for example, or a gospel to the Hebrews. There were documents floating around that recorded Yeshua's words. And some people would even say, and I think it's kind of a stretch, but it's a possibility, would even say that Matthew quotes the Didache in some respects. And there's been a extensive doctoral dissertation written on that topic. And it could be that the Didache was part of those documents that were floating around, or at least part of the Didache before the whole thing was compiled, that parts of it were floating around and may have been part of the source material that Matthew used. Because for sure, the gospel writers didn't write everything out of their head, Luke specifically says that he had source documents. He inquired, yeah. There is what some people call the Q document. I'm a little skeptical about the Q document, how formally organized it was. I think there was just a mass of material, and the credible stuff over time was kept and the less credible was discarded. Maybe when it was debunked, certain sayings were like, Maybe Peter comes along and says, "No, Yeshua never said that." I don't know how exactly it worked, but nevertheless, there is this body of material that was very early, starting from Yeshua's death, when people are passing on his teachings, that informs and becomes part of the basis for the Didache and for the Gospels and actually other writings as well, to a greater or lesser degree.
Yeah, yeah. So I went to Fundy school for a year, and I did a lot of my like curriculum in elementary, middle, and high school was fundamentalist. They really pushed like the Textus Receptus because they didn't like the idea of sources. They didn't like source criticism, redaction criticism, none of that, because they had such a narrow view of what the Holy Spirit could do to inspire scriptures. You know, it had to be a one guy in a dark room getting, you know, almost dictation. They may not go that far, but they were close enough that it was like, he couldn't be reading something else and being like, "That looks good. I'll copy that in here." You know, I think it's time for us to mature beyond that and to say, yeah, obviously Luke says that he got some of this from talking to other people. It doesn't mean it's not inspired. I mean,
yeah,
the Holy Spirit is not limited to, coming to you in a dream with the exact verbiage, you might find it somewhere else. Anyway, yeah, I don't know if any of our listeners needed to hear that, but
well, I think it's relevant. You know, it's even in the evangelical world as a whole, you have the Evangelical Theological Society, and all the, you know, a lot of fundamentalists are part of that too, and they only have two requirements to be a member of that: you believe in the inspiration of Scripture and the deity of Yeshua, or maybe they say the Trinity. But they don't define the inspiration of Scripture. And I think that's really important, because I think there clearly has been a process. The book of Proverbs, for example, clearly says, oh, this chapter, you know, these are the writings of Lemuel. You know, you can clearly see the process that is at work. So it's not the first time that something gets written down that makes it inspired. What it is God overseeing the entire process. And we're putting our faith in God, not in the one guy that we supposed wrote the book.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So one passage in the Didache that I think I'm still absolutely fascinated by it. And you brought this out in your book in a way that I hadn't read before, and I really appreciated it, which was the tonal whiplash of the concession passage. So you have the first five chapters, which is like, there's two ways. There's the way of life, there's the way of death, and there's a massive chasm, a big difference between the two ways, right? You're on one or you're on the other. And here's the way of life and here's the way of death. And then in chapter six, the Didachist is like, but if you can't do it, you know, that's fine. Just do your best.
Yeah. That's which is such a contrast.
Yeah.
If you read the Talmud or Mishnah, it's like, you know, this is the conclusion. We decided to go with Beit Hillel, and you either sink or swim, you go with it, you know, there's no middle ground.
Yeah.
And halacha is like that in Jewish thinking. You know, there is no middle ground. That's why our kosher laws have become so huge and extensive. If it's true that you can't mix milk and meat, and you're a black and white thinker and thinking this way, then yeah, you're justified in going the full way with two fridges, two sinks, two ovens, two sets of cutlery and dishes. But the Didache says, concerning food, bear what you are able, you know, whatever you. So it's kind of saying, maybe when you get to certain things, there is leniency in all of this. And while it's not a theological document per se, nevertheless, it really does point towards an understanding that God is gracious, which Jews know as well, of course, but the mentality here is a little different. So bear what you're able, but then it says, but particularly abstain from that which is offered to idols. That's not negotiable.
Yeah.
You know, some things are negotiable, and even Paul seems to, in my view, have a little ambiguity on certain things, but some things are negotiable, but other things like idolatry, absolutely not.
Yeah. I remember talking to a guy, this reminds me, I was talking to a guy, real smart guy, you know, deep thinker. And we were talking about something that he thought was negotiable. And he used the analogy, well, it's like food sacrificed to idols. And what he meant was, it's like, well, you know, you can do it if you think you can, and you shouldn't do it if you think you can't. And by that time, I think I had already read Chung's Idol Food in Corinth, where he just goes through and it completely blows that idea to shreds. And I was like, what? You can't eat food sacrificed to idols. You can't stop in 1 Corinthians 9 or whatever. You got to keep reading. Paul says you absolutely cannot do this. It's
right.
Not allowed at all.
I think that's a huge problem, even, you know, in the church world, in the messianic world, even today. You know, do I eat in a restaurant that has a statue of Buddha at the back, you know, with little offerings in front of it? Not even just a statue, but it has little offerings. So am I partaking in some way? You know, it's like, I think believers need to really think that one through.
Yeah, maybe learn how to cook.
Yeah.
That's what I did. I got on the internet and I learned how to cook. So here's a question that I think, I don't know, this might be the most common question I get in my capacity as whatever it is I do here. I get, because we hold a theology here at First Fruits of Zion that within the body of Messiah, Jewish people have incredibly well-defined responsibilities to God in the Torah and as it's been passed down through the generations. You know, like you said, separation of meat and milk, and these things are, like, this is Jewish life. This is halacha. This is how Jewish people should live. And we say, you know, Jewish people who are followers of Yeshua live Jewish lives. This is your calling, the halacha hasn't changed. You can't throw that out because you became a follower of Yeshua. However, if you're not Jewish, Peter said, dude, we're not going to put everything onto the Gentiles. We're not going to make them convert. And to me, I see the Didache, and I feel like this comes through in your manuscript and then in Toby's manuscript as well, that this is, the Didache is aware of this. You know, you don't read the passage in the Didache saying, don't forget to put up your mezuzah and put on your tzitzis and don your tefillin and so forth. But it's really difficult for people when you tell them this stuff to figure out which commandments are for Gentiles. Is there a complete list somewhere of commandments for Gentiles that omits all of the commandments that are not absolutely required of a Gentile follower of Yeshua? Do you have a good answer for that question?
Well, yeah, I think you're handing it to me on a plate, because the Didache is really a document like that. It really lays out, this is how you ought to live. This is what you should do. This is what you should avoid in basically in the moral sphere, in terms of your relational sphere with others in the community of disciples of the master. In all of these, this is how you ought to live. And I think that's exactly what it was intended to do. I mean, it is entirely natural that those who are not from Israel, who come and start worshiping the God of Israel and realize who he is, would say, I want to really press into this and I want to do everything. And you've got the documents that are written for Israel and you go, well, this is what he says to do. But I think this is one area where First Fruits of Zion shines, because it's more sophisticated in understanding this than even a lot of New Testament scholars, although New Testament scholarship is catching on to this more and more.
Thankfully.
Yeah. I mean, the New Testament really makes it clear. Paul in his letters is primarily, certainly not exclusively in most cases, primarily addressing those who are not Jewish. So when he says, who has bewitched you, to the Galatians, you know, that you should want to be circumcised, mm-hmm. he is speaking to those who are not Jewish, and he is saying, this is the beauty of the gospel. God has detached his saving plan from Israel and made it obvious to all of the nations. I think it was there before, but now it's been made clear. So this is a mystery made clear,
yeah.
that it is solely by faith that we are saved. And, you know, that's Jewish teaching too. I mean, you go to Jewish writings and it's clear that that all Israel is saved, sure, but there are those within Israel who are not saved because of their evil deeds. That's why we have a book of life, yeah. and a book of death. So there is this individual element that relates to our faith and our walk with God. And the New Testament makes that so clear. All of us, by grace are you saved through faith. You know, this is a Jewish teaching, actually. It's not, it's just clearly spoken by the apostle Shaul so that the nations might understand. But the Didache does not say anything about kashrut. It does say concerning food, what you can. I think that's an ambiguous statement.
Yeah.
It doesn't say anything about Shabbat even, which is a shocker to a lot of people, especially, you know, a lot of people turn to Isaiah 56. And maybe they should look around a little and see the full context of that. But people think that maybe every believer has to keep Shabbat or you'll be punished by God. That's not here. The festivals of Israel, that of course the nations are welcome to join in and to enjoy, but it's certainly not a command. And and so I hope I don't upset anyone, but it's not commanded that all the nations should keep every festival and all of these different things, like you said, Talis Tefillin, all of that, are not mentioned, because there is an aspect to the Torah that is not just commandment, but the Torah in terms of the entire covenant is a covenant between God and a specific people, Israel. And in it, it has God's law. That's part of it. But that is not the whole of the Torah. It is a marriage covenant between God and his people. Mm-hmm. And then God says, because you are my people, not in order to be my people, but because you are my people, you will keep the Sabbath, you will keep these feasts and so forth.
Yeah.
And we need to get out of the thinking that Torah is just the do's and don'ts. Because Torah is so much more than that.
It's true.
And the Didache, I think, shows that. And so, you know, it is extended to the nations. The nations become part of the Commonwealth of Israel, but the nations do not become Israel. Israel still has that distinct role that God has called it to in the nations, to be a light and to be distinct. We need to maintain our distinctiveness, or else God's plan that we see right through to Revelation, the very end of the book of Revelation, would come to naught.
Well said. Well said. Just popping into my head as you were saying that was like, I'm so thankful that finally when E.P. Sanders wrote Paul and Palestinian Judaism, some people started listening and realized that there's lots of grace in Judaism. The whole idea that they are God's people, and it's not like they had to perform to a certain standard to be God's people. They were God's people. The covenant with Abraham. And then they, you know, to answer the question of how should God's people live, God gave them the Torah. But the whole thing was founded on grace. So many people miss that. So many people are still missing that. That's something I wish I could sit down personally with every evangelical pastor and say, look, man, Judaism is also a religion of grace.
Yeah, yeah. That's absolutely true. I mean, you can't read through the Amidah in the Siddur without seeing it. You know, turn us to you, O Lord, and we shall be turned. You're asking for God's grace and mercy. Slach lanu, forgive us, for we have sinned. It's not on the basis of us doing anything. It's just a plea. Please forgive us because we've sinned.
Well, and like, please grant us repentance. I mean,
yeah.
That's how much to unpack it just in that sentence.
Right, right.
Even that comes from Hashem. It's
yeah.
And that's why it's widely understood. And like I said, it's the most prayed prayer in Judaism. It's Shema two times a day, the Amidah three times a day. Grant us repentance. I mean, it's right there. That it's grace.
Yeah.
We got to keep talking about it till everybody knows about it.
Yeah.
So here's a question that I wrote down, and I think now's the time to ask it, because we've established a few things. First of all, the Didache was written by a type of believer that we see in the first century, the second century, maybe later than that, a few centuries later than that, the Jewish Christian or the Christian Jew or the Messianic Jew, a definitively Jewish person who's a follower of Yeshua and continues to live according to their Jewish identity. And we've established that it was popular enough that we see it popping up in apostolic constitutions and in Clement and other places. We find this affinity with and adoption of, approval of the Didache. And then it just disappears. What happened? I mean, is this, what happened to the church that this formerly widely read and accepted document was not just put on the back shelf, but we forgot about it completely? Did something happen to the Didache and community, or was it a theological shift, or what happened?
Yeah, I think there's a couple questions there, but I think what happened in general is that the church became established. By 325, it is an establishment church under Constantine. If you look at the pictures of the group of bishops in Nicaea in 325, Constantine sits in the middle on his throne. You know, he's clearly the guy in charge of the church at that point. And at that point, they're close to winning the war. They've won a lot of battles and they're close to winning the war. And people know what Christianity is, what it stands for. And they know a lot of the ethical requirements of Christianity. And so the need for the Didache is not the same as in the first century, when people thought that belief in Yeshua or belief in the one God was atheism, didn't understand at all the morals of the Jews and the Hebrew Bible. So the need was different. But there's another thing you mentioned about those early communities of Jewish believers. It used to be, and this is where Adolf Harnack was one of the people who taught this, and it was an advance in scholarship in their day. It used to be that people said, there was a Jewish wing of the church and a Gentile wing, and they eventually ended up in conflict with each other, and these different schools basically it resulted in the Jewish stream being diminished to the point of not existing. In reality, the early Jewish believers were both part of the church as a whole. And this is what scholars now are saying, and you can see it. Matthew McCabe writes on it, David Horrell writes on it, and others. This old dichotomy between Peter and Paul, between the Jewish and the Gentile church, is
the Ferdinand Christian Bauer dichotomy.
Yeah, that's it exactly. That dichotomy is not fair to the facts on the ground, because what we see in terms of facts on the ground is there was no sharp dichotomy. And so that's why you have, you know, in the fourth century, you have John Chrysostom preaching against his people who keep going to the synagogue to celebrate the Jewish feasts. And he says some awful things about the Jews, and it is really anti-Semitic, but I don't think that's really his. His big issue is that his people are going to worship in the synagogue and there's a power struggle still going on. So there isn't such a division between Judaism, between Jewish believers, and between the church as we might think. Maybe theologically in some of the writings, but on the ground, just like today, there were many people in the church who on a Jewish festival would say, hey, I'm going to go to the Messianic congregation or whatever and celebrate the feast.
Well, that's where it's at.
Yeah.
was it McCabe who edited, along with Annette Yeshko-Reed, that book, The Ways That Never Parted? Am I thinking of the right person?
Annette Yoshiko-Reed wrote, yeah, I don't think that he had a chapter in there, but he might have.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember.
Maybe I'm thinking of the wrong person. That was a book along the same lines, saying, look, the fact that we see these church fathers in the third, fourth century saying, stop going to synagogue, I mean, they're telling on themselves a little bit. They're revealing to us that this was common. There was still dialogue and a sense that they were sort of part of the same thing. And, you know, the ways didn't fully part until the rise of Islam and all of the weird changes that brought. And really fascinating stuff. And I think I appreciate Ferdinand Christian Bauer for probably popularizing the idea that there even was such a thing as Jewish Christianity. I mean, because before that, you had Reimarus, you had Toland, but you didn't have a really broad stream of people talking about it. It was sort of something a few people were talking about. And then all of a sudden, everybody knew that there were these Jewish Christians. And I think that was a big step. But yeah, I think it took a long time to undo this idea that there were these factions that were antagonistic to each other.
Right. And I think it's still the predominant idea that there was this opposition. But while, of course, there would have been opposition in some cases, most scholars, definitely. There's a trend of realization that, wow, actually the situation was far more nuanced than that.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you brought up the Muslim invasion of the 7th century. You know, that really is the end of where you can trace any form of Jewish Christianity, kind of is demolished at that point, along with the Palestinian academies, as we call them, you know, who wrote the Palestinian Talmud or Jerusalem Talmud. Yeah. They kind of came to an end then too, and everything moved to Babylon.
Man, there's almost too much history to have to have to learn.
You know, the historical context of the Didache, I think part of it that's really relevant is the first century, especially if it is the year 80, and some people would say even earlier than that, other people would say right, you know, into the second century in the 100s. But regardless, you know, around the year 80, things are in tumult. I mean, we think our world is in tumult now, but Jerusalem has been destroyed. We're in that period between 70 and 135, when the Jewish people are trying to figure out what to do without a temple. Actually, not Jerusalem, but the temple has been destroyed. The early Messianic community has, by the accounts we have, been outside of Jerusalem and then has returned, but they've been severely disrupted. And all of this is kind of the background for the Didache. In these tumultuous times when things are so difficult, just as they are today, you know, maybe, but more so.
Yeah.
Now, let's get grounded. How do we live? How do we continue our lives? And what really matters? And so, so that's kind of in the background of the Didache, with this attempt to bring order to these congregations that are springing up everywhere in this very difficult political environment.
Wow. Well, I'm glad it was rediscovered, maybe for such a time as this, just to bring clarity, to bring that first century Jewish voice back into the church. I mean, it seems like that's what we need right now. I don't know. Everyone thinks something different. Everyone's read the New Testament so many times, and they all think it means 100 different things. And here comes the Didache to help us place it all back into a Jewish context, in my opinion.
Yeah.
To me, it's just such a valuable work. And I'm so thankful that you spent the time to clarify that, yes, this is Judaism. This is Judaism talking to Gentiles. This is the Torah, what it has to say to Gentiles, you know, to carry the weight of authority of having been composed so early, containing this stream of tradition of sayings of Jesus that the Gospels also drew from. I mean, what a fascinating work.
It is. It really is. We're blessed that it was found. And I believe we'll find more documents in the future too. Who knows?
Oh, that's what I'm hoping for. You know, another Cairo Geniza, another Dead Sea Scrolls. I mean, it feels like there's a few holes left that need to be filled. And Hashem, I think, has these things all timed out. Just when we think we know, we'll find something else. And it will, it's gonna blow our minds.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Dr. Daniel Nassim, for joining us and talking about your work on the Didache. Again, his book is Torah for Gentiles, which I think is underselling it a little bit. I would say Torah for Gentiles, period. But I won't second guess Dr. Nassim's title. What the Jewish authors of the Didache had to say. You can pick it up anywhere books are sold. If you want a more popular level treatment, buy Toby's book, The Way of Life. It's easier to understand, but of course it wasn't written by a PhD. So you're going to have to get them both.
That's right.
Buy both books, everybody. Okay, well, thanks again, Dr. Nassim, for joining us on Messiah Podcast.
Sounds great. Thank you very much. Real pleasure talking to you, and hello to all your listeners, and goodbye. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today on Messiah Podcast. If you're interested in learning more about the Jewish Jesus, check out First Fruits of Zion at ffoz.org. And if you enjoyed this episode, please give us a 5-star rating wherever you're listening. Messiah Podcast is made possible by the generosity of our First Fruits of Zion friends. FFOZ friends are people like you who support our mission and get loads of exclusive Bible commentary, teaching, and content. You can join today at ffoz.org. Tune in next time for more great conversations. Until then, I'm Jacob Franczak. Shalom.
Like the waters cover the sea.